Welcome to Dohua's Encounters with China podcast. As part of this podcast series, and to mark this Lunar New Year of the Dragon, we're focusing on the theme, Dragon Year, Remembrance of Times Past. In this series, we will take you, the listener, on a journey through time, first by sharing John's impressions of an emerging China in 1976, a year that brought about momentous changes for the Chinese mainland, and then moving through the milestone years of 1988, 2000, 2012, and finishing with the present day. My name is Siwan Leong, and in this first episode, John talks about the road that led to his arriving in China in 1976 and what he experienced when he finally landed there.
I credit my mother for my interest in China. In 1969, when I was admitted to Princeton University, and in the summer, as I was getting ready to go, I had to choose my courses. My mother came into the living room. I was sitting up with my feet on the wall, and she said, all right, John, it's time for you to choose your courses. I said, okay. So she pulls out the little form you filled in, and she had the course catalog, and she said, okay, you have got to take a social science. And I said, okay. And she said, I'll read them off. And the first one was anthropology. And I said, good, I'll take that. Then I had to take a science. And she read those off. And the first one was astronomy. And I said, oh, that sounds good. I've always liked to look up at the skies, you know. So she could see where this was going. She said, now you have to take a language. And I said, well, okay, read them. And the first one was Arabic. And I said, no, I don't think so. I don't like living in the desert. And so then she said, Chinese. And I said, oh, yes, I like Chinese food. So let's do Chinese. And she said, you know, I think that's a good idea. Because if you learn an exotic language, which is what she called Chinese, an exotic language, you will always be able to get a job. And that turned out to be very, very good advice. So I took anthropology and I took Chinese. At Princeton, there was a little office called Princeton in Asia with a gentleman by the name of Bob Atmore. So I go in there one day, shortly after I decided I would graduate early. So I go in there and I said, what do you have in Macau? He took out this, I always remember, he took out this like card file, you know, where you open it up and there are cards. He like blew dust off of it and up came the dust. And then he looked and he said, ah, yes, Lincoln College is in Macau. Why did I want to go to Macau? Well, in those days, again, I fancied myself something of a pro-China panda, you call him a panda hugger now. In any event, I didn't want to go to Taiwan because, of course, that was under the rule of the Kuomintang, and I didn't want that. And I didn't want to go to Hong Kong because in Hong Kong, it was under the British. It was a colonial city. So that kind of left Macau. So and by 1972, Macau was, in effect, a Chinese-ruled city. They let the Portuguese hang on for a while because they didn't want to affect Hong Kong. That was the goose that was laying the golden eggs for them, even back then. I was teaching at a little school by the name of Lincoln College. I was supposed to teach English and history, but because the school had hit some bad times and they couldn't afford salary. So all the other teachers eventually left. That left me to teach everything. I mean, I was teaching science, mathematics, even though I hadn't taken any mathematics in college, history, Chinese history, Western history, English. But because the school couldn't afford salaries, I mean, I was really living sort of hand to mouth. I learned how to gamble, and I was very lucky, so I made some money gambling.
Hong Kong isn't just a single island. There are 236 of them.
On Christmas Day 1972, John left Macau and headed for Hong Kong. Hong Kong was a British colony that had been seized from China in 1841 during the First Opium War. John landed a part-time job tutoring at the Chinese University of Hong Kong and took the opportunity to do field work in the New Territories, an area right next to the border of China.
I was introduced to that work by the archivist, Ian Diamond. He put me in touch with the New Territories. The New Territories Administration would set up meetings with the local elders and what have you. There were still a few people alive who had fought the British in 1897. So I interviewed them, and I got a hold of what's called a jukbo, which is the genealogy. And in that, they told the story of the British coming to take the lands up in the New Territory of the Dung Clan. There were parts of the New Territories where foreigners could not enter. They were like Ngachun, which is near Gumtin, and is a Hakka area. These guys, you know, they didn't want anything to do with the Brits or any other foreigners, so you couldn't go in there. That's where I first encountered China during the Cultural Revolution. My dream of visiting China after living in Macau and Hong Kong since 1972 was actually in January 1976, when I was a freshly minted representative of the National Council for U.S.-China Trade. I was asked to attend trade fairs in China, starting with so-called mini-fairs.
Like other Westerners drawn to China's vision at the time, John imagined a paradise of workers building a new society. That was soon to change.
My initial impressions of China were a rather dark place, quite underdeveloped. Remember, the Gang of Four was in charge. Very repressive. I witnessed arrests and detentions in 1976. So my initial impressions of China were not too favorable.
The heart of the great proletarian revolutionary and outstanding communist fighter, Comrade Zhou Enlai, ceased to beat.
Now, during my travels to China, I went to Zhou Enlai's funeral. He died in January of 76. I was awakened during the evening when Zhou died by the sound of fighting down below on Suzhou Creek. It was a very, very tense time. An elderly room attendant came to my room the next morning, and I said, "Hey, what happened last night?" He was weeping, and he said, "Well, Zhou Enlai has died." And oh, man, you know, that was a big blow. So the Gang of Four, they hated Zhou Enlai. They took various measures to make sure that nobody commemorated him. Instead of honoring Zhou Enlai by declaring a break from business, no. How did they put it? "We will turn grief into strength," or some such nonsense.
On the 28th of July, 1976, an earthquake with a magnitude of 7.8 struck Tangshan, an industrial city in northern China. The earthquake was felt some 68 miles away in Beijing, where John was staying.
So there I was. I mean, I was in my hotel room on the 14th floor of the Beijing Hotel, Peking Hotel. There I am lying in my bed. I'm about to go to Tianjin the next day. And at roughly 2:57 a.m., the room started to shake up and down, like, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. Many of us, I did anyway, thought that the Russians were nuking us. You know, in those days, the relationship was terrible. And I really thought that was the case because as I looked out the window, there were these power stations that were exploding on the horizon. And then the swaying began. And right as it hit the top of the pendulum, I thought the building was going over the next time. I tried to remember all the prayers I had learned as an altar boy in New Jersey. And then
the pendulum came back. It was really frightening.
Officials say the earthquake killed over 242,000 people, but that wouldn't be the last trauma of 1976 for China. On September the 9th, Mao Zedong, China's leader since 1949, passed away.
Canton Trade Fair was first held in 1957, and it has continued without interruption until the present day. I began attending the trade fair for the National Council in 1976. I attended the 39th session and continued to do so, the 40th, the 41st, the 42nd, and so on. The trade fair in those days really was the only venue for conducting a trade with China. It's true that a few hardy souls went up to Beijing and negotiated some contracts, but the majority of trade took place at the Canton Fair. It was well attended by Europeans and the Japanese in Hong Kong, but not by the Americans. The Americans started to attend after the Nixon visit. Initially, it was small in attendance, but that gradually grew. Foreign trade was dominated by the central government, so we did business with the head offices of the foreign trade corporations, like Sinochem, cereals, oils, and foodstuffs.
Now, during the trade fair, Europeans and Americans stayed at a hotel designated for foreigners. Japanese and Hong Kong businessmen had their own designated hotels. Our hotel was the Dongfang. Is located right across the street from the trade fair complex. The U.S. consulate was also located there eventually after 1975. And the fair was a hotbed for networking and exchanging insights into China. And I still remember it fondly as the home base for my first forays into China during the waning days of the Cultural Revolution. Now, for the fair, my wife and I would haul crates of equipment and other goods from Hong Kong to Guangzhou, passing through the border town of Sumjun, where the crates, more than 40 of them, were opened and inspected by Chinese customs. In addition to the crates of equipment, food and drink, we carried to Guangzhou hundreds of copies of Canton Companion, which was a magazine my wife and I put together that was published by Far East Trade Press.
For a while, it was one of the very few Western publications that were allowed to circulate in China. When I say allowed to circulate, I didn't seek permission. We simply packed them and brought them up to the trade fair, put them on a table in the office of the council, and distributed them. It was very popular, of course. There was a lot of useful information in there. We published all kinds of interesting articles, including accounts of trips outside of Guangzhou. We did features on Cantonese opera. We even did an article on the Democracy Wall.
Now, there was plenty of time to wander the streets of Guangzhou. And occasionally, one would see a court notice of executions, including counter-revolutionaries, posted on the walls of the city. Now, these notices, they were all over the place. And whenever criminals, including counter-revolutionaries, were executed, you would see a big red check mark at the bottom. That signified that the executions had taken place. In 1983, I learned of the executions of two Hong Kong young men who had hung a large banner with counter-revolutionary slogans like "Down with the Communist Party" outside their hotel room at the Guangzhou Hotel. They went outside and they took photographs, after which they headed to the train station to go back to Hong Kong. Well, they didn't make it. They were taken into custody, after which they were tried, convicted, and executed. The execution of these two young men for hanging a poster out of their window prompted outrage among the people of Hong Kong. It marked the last time that Hong Kong people were executed for political crimes. I often wandered into stores to see what was on offer. The only foreign consumer goods available for purchase in those days were, as mentioned before, Swiss watches, but also Albanian cigarettes and North Korean brandy, and books by leaders of friendly countries. Unlike virtually every other Asian city, there were no nightclubs in Guangzhou. There are certainly not massage parlors, no brothels, anything of that sort. There was, however, a bar on the eighth floor of the Dongfang Hotel, a storied top of the Fang. And there were dozens of restaurants around town where businessmen could rent rooms separate from locals. When you entered the restaurant, they would say, "Well, what's your standard in Cantonese native? Yujun." You know, you could say something like, "Oh, 10 renminbi a head." And you would get, 12 courses. Really fantastic. The other thing you could do was to go on a tour. The trade fair authorities would put together tours of places inside and outside the city of Guangzhou. You would visit communes. And I always took advantage of that. I must have visited a dozen, maybe not that many, 10 communes, production brigades, etc., including, very memorable, the one in Dongguan County. Dongguan County was the center of the fireworks industry. I also remember visiting a hospital to observe operations on under acupuncture anesthesia. The patient on cue would sit up and wave to the foreign guests. Some of the audience fainted. In beginning of 1950, early 1950s, there were no foreigners living in Guangzhou. That changed when the Polish government formed a Sino-Polish shipping company, and they set up a consulate in Xiamen. The other office in Xiamen was the North Korean DPRK trade office. They used that office to purchase things in Hong Kong and Macau. Initially, they were quite hostile. But, you know, Jimmy Carter, who was elected in 1976 in November, right at the time of the trade fair, he had run on removing American troops from South Korea. And, of course, the North Koreans were delighted with that. So when I met them at the Swiss reception, they were very friendly, invited me to come to their trade office on Xiamen. I said, "Well, okay, let me think about it." So I went to see the liaison office at the Dongfang. They had three liaison offices, one for the European Americans, another for the Japanese in the Bai Yun Hotel, and then for the Hong Kong-Macau compatriots, the Tongbao. So I went down there, and actually, the head of the liaison office was from the Ministry of Public Security. Later, he was called China's 007. He was China's James Bond. Very elegant fellow, Shanghainese, dressed to the T's. I mean, he wore cashmere coats and the whole bit. So I went down to see this guy. And I said, hey, listen, I've been invited to visit the North Korean trade representative. And he said, no way. You are our guest. You don't go where we don't want you to go. Oh, okay. That's when I realized, really for the first time, that the relationship between North Korea and China, which had been variously described as close as lips and teeth, it wasn't close as lips and teeth. Then and now, a lot of friction between China and North Korea. So that's that. I never got to actually go there.
These were the waning days of the Cultural Revolution. In September 1976, Chairman Mao died. The following month, October 1976, the Gang of Four was overthrown.
My wife and I became good friends of the Polish Consul General and his wife,
and they told me a lot of stories of what had happened in Guangzhou during the Cultural Revolution, some of which were quite terrible. There were churches, a Protestant and a Catholic church on Xiamen, and they were forced to close. And I'm very sorry to say that the priests were marched out and were in effect executed.
Before visiting China in mid-1970s, I fancied myself an admirer of Chairman Mao and his sayings in his little red book. What I saw and heard back then changed me. I was no longer a panda hugger, which is a term applied to those who hold that China can do no harm.
John's view of China may have changed, but his trips there in the 1970s were just the beginning of his career and a relationship that has lasted since. In our next episode, we explore the years leading up to 1988, when John is at the height of his corporate career, and how fateful events at the end of the decade in China changed the course of John's life. You can read about all of John's experiences at www.dohua.org under John Cam Remembers. And you'll also find there all the work Dohua has done over the past 25 years. We would love to hear from you about the stories and podcasts, so please reach out to us via our website. And be sure to subscribe for the next episode of our special series, Dragon Year: Remembrance of Times Past. Thank you so much for listening.